pack, session number 31044, reel 5.
The night before, a sailor had been out on the batter and was walking through the public park in a euphoric state when he came upon the bonfire. Ah! Set fire to him. The bloody bonfire went off and the wind was in the wrong direction. We spent all that time, the whole night, stemming sparks coming over from. So that's what I remember about VJ night. Dreadful.
Going back to your time with the 355 squadron, how regularly would you fly on operations?
Oh, about, well, there wasn't much regularity to it, but I would say twice a week, something like that. About the trips were very long. The squadron, I do believe, had, I wasn't on it, but had the record bombing trip. Well, it wasn't a bombing trip, it was a photo reconnaissance trip from Calcutta to Singapore and back, 21 hours in the air. And that, I think, at the time, was the longest trip that had ever been undertaken by a bomber. And the Liberator was ideal for that. It was stripped down to its essentials. Extra tanks put in for fuel. Carried no gunners, no bombs. Just two pilots, navigator, two wireless ops. And a flight engineer and a photographer. Yeah. And it was to take the mosquitoes that were doing the bridges, the photographic reconnaissance units couldn't get as far as Singapore, and the photographs had to be got, and it was Liberators that were sent.
How were you then spending your off-duty time? How were you spending the off-duty time?
Off-duty, on the squadron. I learned to play bridge, for a start, and after the war, I took it up seriously, and I became quite a good bridge player. In fact, I captained a team in the Perthshire Bridge League, which had four internationals in it. Yeah. So my bridge evolved into quite a high standard, and it all started in Salmoni, rudimentary bridge. But most of the time, some people went a bit... I don't know whether it was the heat, the strain, or the... My rear gunner, incidentally, had to be taken off flying. He was, that's the one that selected the crew. He was just a heap of nerves all the time. He had to be taken off.
Had that crew come with you to India?
Long before we got to India, yes. OTU, yes.
Would you be able to explain a bit more about the base itself at Salmoni and the domestic arrangements?
Domestic arrangements? You mean in the various messes?
At Salmoni, yeah.
Uh-huh. Well, basically you've got the sergeant's mess and the officer's mess. Sergeant's mess, how would you describe it? It's privileged to a certain extent that... you are NCOs, and the senior NCOs, the warrant officers and so forth, have a kind of privileged position. Usually quite well run, and run by a mess committee. At Gainsmouth, it was absolutely wonderful. The mess committee was three of us, I think, went and got the beer from the brewers. Decided on the prices and so forth, but that was unusual. The normal sergeant's mess, nothing memorable about it. I don't know what officers' messes were like, but at Gainsmouth we didn't have an officer's mess because there was only one officer. He shared the sergeant's mess with us and enjoyed the free beer and whiskey and so forth.
Would each crew spend the time as a unit together?
Yes, it tended to, yes. Uh-huh. It tended to. Jesus. That was me and my all my glory.
What was your flying kit then?
Sorry?
What was the flying kit that you had?
That's wings, and I did get an award after the war. Not a very important one, but it was an award as distinct given to me when I was in the reserve.
For what is that awarded?
Well, I didn't know what it was awarded for at the time, and I've only noticed since that in the obituaries in the Times, when an RAF officer dies, an exer, and he has had this award, he puts it after his name, and I found out from one of these obituaries that it's 10 years flying as the CO at Schoon, that's where I was. At the time, he said, the Lord Lieutenant should really present this to you. He says, you've actually been flying for 12 years and so far you haven't broken an aeroplane. I said, that's good. Yes. He said, but if you want the Lord Lieutenant to present it, that's your privilege. Other than that, we can go down to the local pub and have a drink on it with the boys. So I said, that sounds like a good idea. And that's what we did. And that's the Air Efficiency Award. And these officers that have had it have got AE after their name. But it never occurred to me it was that important. I've got the usual campaign medals, the Bomber Star and all this.
How did the air crews relate to the ground crews?
There's not much coming and going between them. Not a lot. I don't know whether it's a kind of snobbishness or not. Hard to say. That's a friend of mine that Bill Reed.
You mentioned before the RAF crew's degenerative behaviour and the tendency to visit the flesh uh-huh. pots and so on. Did the RAF have a policy about the behaviour of their crews?
Not as such, as far as I know. Can't remember any. So, you know, you were given a fair bit of latitude, but my friend Joe MacArthur was a bit of a tearaway. Now, he was up in the Himalayas with me, and we came back to the squadrons, and Joe had an exercise to do, I think. He wasn't immediately sent back to for another aircraft, the same as I was. And the exercise was over the Bay of Bengal. And Joe had been low-flying over the Bay of Bengal, had executed a turn and dipped his wing in the sea, and it killed half his crew. Joe survived, but he was taken off flying. And that was unusual to get somebody that does something as stupid as that. Yeah. But he was like that. He was a tearaway, Joe. But you didn't get many of them. Most of us were very, very cautious. But one of my first operations was with a chap called Jock Campbell, a warrant officer. and considerably older than the rest of us. And he was on his last operation, and it was the big one, which was Rangoon. And Jock came from Falkirk in the Scottish Midlands area. And he was quite a broad speaker in many ways. But we get to Rangoon, and it was a night op, and the searchlights are all over the sky, and the flak's coming up, and Jock says, "Hang on, what we do now is we stooge around for 5 minutes outside Rangoon." "Why is that, Jock?" He says, "You'll find out in a minute." So we stooge around, and eventually the searchlights coned a Liberator. Jock says, "Right, in we go." Woof, in and out. He said, "They can only deal with one at a time, and that poor boy's had it." He says, "Once they cone you, you'll be shot down." And he said, "That's the time," he said. And unfortunately, at that time, prior to that, we hadn't been taking pictures of bombers, but the word came through that the RAF wanted evidence of what you'd just done. So the bomb aimer was charged with the duty. It hadn't got synchronized cameras of actually working the camera at the same time as he worked his bombs away switch. So after whistling through over rang the target, the marshalling yards, and dropping the bombs, the bomb aimer pips up and says, "Joe, I forgot the 40. And Joe says, "Fuck the 40, we're halfway home now." So that was very instructive to me, yes.
How much thought did the crews give to the people on the receiving end of the raid?
Well, the thing is that in our theatre of war, we couldn't afford indiscriminate bombing. Because ostensibly, the civilian population weren't hostile. So the bombing had to be at very definite Japanese targets. And the intention was to keep civilian casualties to the absolute minimum. And as far as I know, we quite succeeded in that. And as far as I know as well, the effect on the Japanese army against our 14th Army was quite devastating, because they were short of virtually all the ordnance and food and fuel, so due to our efforts. So I feel that we did some good, although you couldn't actually see the... It wasn't like bombing Berlin or something like that, with your carpet bombing. We weren't. We were definitely on Japanese targets, and Japanese targets alone. We couldn't offend the civilian population.
How much contact did you have with Japanese pilots and Japanese fighters?
None whatsoever. No, I have. The only Japanese that I met was very much post-war, and that was a Japanese girl nurse, and her father had been the commanding officer in Singapore, and had, after the war, had tried to kill himself by harakiri, and had been unsuccessful in that as well, because he was still alive.
What was your attitude then towards the Japanese and earlier the Germans throughout the war?
Well, I can't remember any particular burning hatred or anything like that. You know, they were the enemy, but I had no particular desire to go out and kill people. And our job was to cut the lines of communication. And I don't think in our case that we killed an awful lot of people, Japanese. But as I say, there was no intense hatred. And then after the war, when I had to deal with 120 Italian prisoners and then 120 German prisoners, I got to quite like them.
was there, do you suppose, any element of the separation between the an aircrew and the enemy, as it were? Would that make a difference to the attitudes to?
Well, I saw a lot of Japanese intelligence reports on the squadron, and they had orders that aircrew that were shot down and captured were to be summarily executed. And that wasn't so funny, you know. Incidentally, one of our local retired ministers of religion lives in Kenmore, a good friend of mine, and his name is Kenneth McVicar. Now, Kenneth was in the same theatre of war, but he was a fighter pilot, he was flying Hurricanes. And he wasn't shot down. He hit a tree. He was doing a low sweep. And that brought him down behind the Japanese lines. He actually walked through the Japanese lines and got back to his squadron again, which was at Cox's Bazaar in Arakan, North Burma. And Kenneth got the DFC for that. And it's rather funny because we were in the same theatre of war, you know. The Hurricanes provided fighter escort on occasion, but they weren't much good against the Zeros. Anyway, Kenneth always accused me of being a bus driver. And I always accused him as being the only man that I know that got the DFC for walking. He walked out through the Japanese line. He's written a book called The Wings of the Morning, which is rather good. The man you've seen tomorrow has written a book as well about his experiences as a doctor. And I rather think he's written one with his wartime experiences as well. A very interesting man.
What's your attitude now towards the war as a whole?
Well, when you get to 86, you don't feel strongly about anything. Not really, you don't. You're just glad to be alive and hope that things carry on for a bit longer. That's about it.
You were a member of...
I was a member of a club in Glasgow before the war.
How did you come to be involved?
And that was a very scruffy club called the Tobers. There were three clubs at that time. The Craigdhu, the Romans, and the Tobers. And I was a member of the Tobers, of which is now long defunct. But the Craigdhu was... the famous Hamish McInnes's lot. Yeah. Hamish McInnes, a very famous climber, that's him there. And that's my late wife. And that's Maura Kerr, the singer, composer, and myself, of course. Hamish was a member of the Craigdhu, and they're top class climbers. And he's been an advisor on many, many films, like Clint Eastwood's Agus Sanction and films like this. And he's also done quite a lot of first ascents.
What was it that appealed about the climbing to you? What was it about climbing that appealed to you?
I don't know. In the post office, which was a bit mundane before the war, there were one or two climbers, and I listened to them, and I got quite interested in their stories. Thought I'd like to have a go. And at that time we were on shifts, and it was quite good. At a weekend you could do a night shift on the Friday night, which meant you were off from Saturday morning, and you could do a late shift on the Monday, which gave you quite a long weekend. And at that time, getting up to Arica was the trouble, because the bus was quite expensive for the likes of us £4 a week lads, and we hitchhiked. Well, we weren't getting £25 a week, I think it was at that time, before the war. And we hitchhiked up to Arica and slept a night in the caves and climbed on the Cobbler, which is a magnificent rock peak. So since then I've climbed the highest mountain in Spain, which is actually in Tenerife, the Drakensbergs, and up to nearly 19,000 feet in the Himalayas. The Himalayas was absolutely fabulous. Got a lot of pictures there, starting at the and that's the Cobbler. That's where I started my climbing career.
What did you have in the way of equipment at the time?
Well, when we started, all we had was boots with clinkers. Not the tikkunis. Clinkers were soft metal that formed around about the edge of the sole, working on the principle that the hard rock bit into the soft metal, and they gave you quite a good grip. And they were replaced with the tikkunis, which worked on the opposite principle. They were hard steel, and they bit into soft rock. That and the hemp ropes, which weighed a ton when they were wet, yes. You know, they really did, yes. But that was all. We had no tikkunis in those days, no safety ropes, nothing like that.
Were you much aware of the sort of the greater climbing scene in Scotland and the general ethos at the time?
Oh, at that time in Glasgow, the climbing scene, there was a lot of people went up at weekends to places like Arica. But it was good to have such a wonderful peak as the Cobbler on the doorstep, well, not exactly on the doorstep, but fairly close at hand. And this is the South Peak here. And the South Peak has a very long ridge in it called the Southeast Ridge. And it's not difficult at all. But coming off it on this side is quite difficult. And this is the central peak that this is taken from. And I think that's just above a climb called the Recess Route, which was severe. I got to the severe stage, never beyond that. Beyond that was exceptionally severe and exposed. And I only got to the severe stage, which was fine, yeah. But I did enjoy my mountain days. This is the Himalaya. Most of these peaks were unnamed where we were up the Tajibas Valley.
Did you manage any first ascent?
Well, that's our base camp, isn't it? Is that Sonamarg? Yeah. And this is a Tajibas. And we did a trek up into Ladakh over the Zojilar Pass. And they have these, what's known as dak bungalows, just for travellers. And they're basic, but they give you shelter at night there. That's myself and Joe MacArthur there.
What sort of reception did you get from the local population?
We didn't see very many there. When you consider it, we went up the the valley of the River Sindh, up by Kangan and Gund. But what we did see were yak trains coming over from Tibet with various goods, mainly furs and things like that. And they always stopped us because they were always short of salt. That's the one thing that they wanted, was salt. And we'd been well warned about this, and we carried quite a lot of salt with us. Oh, what a marvellous. He's an interesting chap, Gordon Whittle. He was a trader in the north of New Guinea when the war started. And the Japanese, of course, had a beachhead eventually on the north of New Guinea. And Gordon walked all the way right across New Guinea to Port Moresby in the south, where he eventually got a boat and back home again. But it's a terrible journey from the north to the south of New Guinea. No, that's Wilfred Nice.
How could you come by all the gear for this? How could you come by all the gear for this expedition?
Well, all we had was hemp ropes. We didn't have gear as such. Our boots were army boots, and Wilfred Nice had persuaded a blacksmith in Rawalpindi to put rudimentary sort of clinkers in them. They weren't real clinkers. So the gear we had was absolutely rudimentary, and we had no windproof clothing. All we had was our battle dresses. The like of Wilfred Nice and Harry Tillian, they had gear that they had brought with them, and that's me there on an ice wall. Well, the ice axes were made by the blacksmith in Norpin. I've still got mine. Down in the garage.